Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. This is Keith Pannell, and as is often the case, I'm here with co-host Russ Chinelli. And today we're going to be talking to people who are involved very heavily in a wonderful organization called the Center for Research and Entrepreneurship and Innovative Enterprises. It sounds pretty wonderful, and it's sort of using technology, and probably mostly technology that's sort of developed by intellectual exercises in the universities, and try to get it out there into the market, make money, get jobs. Russell, who are our guests?
Yes, we're very happy to welcome to Science Studio Gary Williams, who is the director of CREE, and also Jenny Clark, who is the associate director. Welcome to Science Studio.
Thank you.
Gary.
Thank
and you. Jenny. And we all know in today's economy in the United States that we need to have more entrepreneurs. And those of us who are scientists or engineers here in the university are looking for ways that what we do research with our students can create new opportunities for companies, jobs for our students, and so on and so forth. And that's what CREE does. And Gary, why don't you tell us a little bit more about how CREE formed and how you got involved?
Okay. CREE was formed a little over 3.5 years ago. It was an outcome of a Kauffman Foundation grant that the university had to help stimulate entrepreneurship and innovation on campus. And as a way to sustain the investment that Kauffman made here, it was decided to set up a center whose main mission is to help students, faculty, staff, and local entrepreneurs commercialize their technology. So that's what we've been about now for a little over 3.5 years. We're having a lot of fun, and I think we're making some good progress in terms of taking technologies, principally right now that are invented and developed here on campus, putting together teams of people that are either knowledgeable or unknowledgeable about starting companies and helping them with that so that we can create new companies and new jobs for our graduates and other people in town that are looking for something that's really challenging.
So part of that idea then is not just to create jobs, period, but to create them here, mm-hmm. an area where they're badly needed.
That's exactly right. I mean, we have all kinds of people coming from in town, out of country, looking for help. And as long as their final destination is El Paso, we do what we can to help them.
So let's say that Keith walks in here and he's got a great idea that could be commercialized. What does he do first with you?
Well, normally what we do is have a little chat, a non-confidential chat about his idea. We do it in a non-confidential way, just to mitigate the obligation of a non-disclosure agreement, which would be the next step to really get in more detail about the exact science and the exact technology.
I don't know what a non-disclosure
agreement is. I'm sorry. Non-disclosure agreement is also known as a secrecy agreement. And what it does is it protects the parties from people that have not participated in signing that agreement to keep the knowledge within the parties that have signed the agreement so that trade secrets and other technologies don't inadvertently or advertently wind up in the hands of somebody else who could go ahead and run away with the idea.
Once you sign this, it's sort of don't go around blabbing on the street about
that's
this
exactly
great
right.
idea.
That's exactly right.
The penalty if you do? For example, in a university, that's extremely difficult quite often, where a graduate student, for example, has to defend a thesis within which are the essential elements of this sort of discovery.
Right.
And that's open to the public.
Correct. Right?
And so I remember being asked to leave a defense about 4 years ago, and I obviously refused, but then I had to sign a little non-disclosure.
It might have been the first one that you signed since CREE was started. I mean,
it was all to do with iron oxide, removing arsenic from water.
I remember it.
But it's a normal procedure in well-established universities that do this, that you can have closed thesis.
You mean not open to the public?
Yes.
Correct.
Yeah,
or
I mean, you can understand why that sort of is not always acceptable.
Correct. I mean, there's other alternatives. One is to go ahead and file a patent before the public disclosure, which is the best choice. The other alternative is if it's been disclosed in the United States or elsewhere, you have 1 year in the United States to file a patent. Now, that makes a lot of people happy that they have a year to do that. Unfortunately, if it's the idea has been disclosed without an NDA, non-disclosure agreement, or a secrecy agreement, you have basically given up all foreign filing rights. So if your idea is one that's going to change the world, and you unfortunately disclosed it before you filed the patent, you're only going to be able to change the United States part. The other part will have to be done.
Or create jobs elsewhere, too.
I mean, exactly.
What about the first to file, though? Doesn't that give the opportunity now that it's a public disclosure? If somebody else takes the idea, can they run and be first to file?
The jury's out on that. Yeah, I mean, we're talking about a significant change in the patent laws here in the United States come the middle of March, where the laws will be pretty much the same as that are followed in Europe and elsewhere in the world. First to file, not first to invent.
Right.
So it's going to be a whole new story, and we're actively—
So then, in fact, the presentation at a meeting or something would not be classified as filing. That's just disclosing the idea.
That's a public disclosure.
So right. Jenny's right. And I mean, I give my talk in Moscow, and all of a sudden somebody files a patent in Europe. I'm screwed.
There's still going to be some possibilities of you demonstrating that the idea was yours. You can't go ahead and steal somebody's idea and quick file it. There still has to be a replication that it actually was your idea.
So you'd have to have a notebook saying that you
yeah, or some other witness or some other documentation that
I think
assures.
The big difference is it used to be that when they got into a fight, you would go back before the filing and look at notebooks that somebody signed 2 years ago, but that's not going to be the same anymore.
Okay, so it's going to be a streamlined process.
Yeah, and
it's
more.
There'll probably be a lot of lawsuits.
Yeah, I know.
It's more work for lawyers.
Yeah, but let me go back. And first thing you would do, and you talk about it, non-disclosure agreement, secrecy agreement. Now, the next thing you want to do is file a patent, let's say. Okay, and that means that you file a disclosure and you bring it to our committee and so on and so forth. And then, Jen, you have students, interns working on this. What do they do?
We have students depending on their workload. Sometimes it's me that does a market research to determine the size of the market and whether this is a worthwhile avenue for the university to pursue. Now, this obviously just applies to technologies that are invented here in the university, because this is a committee, the Intellectual Property Committee, that meets to decide whether they're going to file for probably
whether,
a provisional
UTEP's
patent.
Whether UTEP's going to spend the money, basically.
Yes, exactly. And so we'll do a whole research of the size of the market and how quickly it's growing. And since we have limited dollars, it would be ideal if we could file on, you know, all the wonderful inventions, but limited dollars.
Well,
and
tell
these
us
patents
a little bit
are
about
little
the
bit.
Interns and students. Are they science majors or MBAs or
we
students?
Have a mixture of all kinds. I've recently been recruiting, and we hired an undergraduate, but at the same time, I did keep it open. We anticipate in the future being able to hire some graduate students as well. Typically, juniors, seniors, we've been taking initially from business, but now we've expanded to engineering and also science.
Let's get a size idea. How many people work in the center? So we've got the director, we've got the associate director, and then what happens?
And right now we have 5 interns. That are
that's what Jenny was talking about.
Supporting the effort. Mm-hmm. There's also the manager of technology transfer, Susan Avena, who watches over everything that has to do with the patents. She also helps with the non-disclosure agreements. She deals with the patent attorneys. She deals with the intellectual property committee.
And the patent attorneys are hired by the university?
Correct.
They're part of the UT system.
Correct. We now
Outside
work with
counsel.
3 patent firms that have been approved by UT system that have been approved for us to work with. One here in El Paso and 2 others throughout Texas, 1 in Dallas and 1 in Austin that we deal with.
We have administration support, and then we also have someone who's specifically responsible for biological inventions and helping promote and commercialize those.
And the initial stimulus, the initial sort of grant, if you like, to get it up and running, was from this Kaufman Institute. That's in Kansas, I believe, is it not?
Yes. They're really the gold standard
right. In
terms of entrepreneurship here in the United States. So and they do work outside the United States. And,
so they fund you initially with a block grant. Do you have to match that to get an endowment, or has all their money run away and you're now getting funds from wherever you can?
Our funding right now comes principally from the state. And we also have 2 grants, both from the Emerging Technology Fund. These were grants that were, one, to help commercialize technologies that came out of 2 of the research superiority centers on campus. We've also been able to, by hook or by crook, get some contributions and other money that helps with some of the important things that we have to do. So we're actively looking for grants that we write proposals for and
Nonstop business.
We right? also have a donation link if anybody would like to go to the homepage.
Do all universities have this?
To a great extent, they do. I mean, to different degrees. You know, the smaller universities that do, let's say, smaller amounts of research will have limited staff. Some of it is outsourced. You get to the big universities like UT Austin, and they've got
And you know that I've worked with Stanford and MIT who have big, big operations
right.
in this.
Right. I mean, as our research budget increases, there will be more people working in the laboratories, making prototypes, developing intellectual property that is going to be ripe for commercialization. And we're under actually the eye of the Board of Regents who is challenging us to increase the return that we get on the research that's being done. So, you know,
so for every
take
X
it very
dollars
seriously.
The state gives you, you've got to at some stage show that we've made NX
right.
dollars.
Right. I mean, for us, the center was set up to eventually become the catalyst for entrepreneurship and innovation in this region and to be a vehicle that will wind up in new companies formed, lots of new jobs created with better wages than we otherwise would see here in the region. And that's really how we gauge whether we're going to support an idea or support somebody or not.
And licensing fees coming back to the institution as well as the
exactly.
organization.
I mean, license fees, I think, are certainly one appropriate measure of the work that we do relative to commercialization. But job creation, company formation, other grant opportunities that otherwise wouldn't have been there without the commercialization activities are other very important metrics that we look at.
Let me tell you a story, and you see what your sort of joint reactions to this is, and Russ also. I had an excellent postdoc work with me about 6 years ago, and he went away. He was cream of the crop in terms of the science, material science, and things of that nature. And then he got a job in a small startup company in Colorado making widgets. They were optical widgets, and they were very, very good for putting in rangefinders for cameras and things like that. And he got patents, and he knew the secrets on how to apply the patent, which is another story we come to. Russ knows about this much better than I. But it drew attention, and it drew attention of a bigger company. They came and swallowed the little company. And then after about a year, they said, oh, this is really a bit too small for us. And they sold it to another company, which happened to be in Japan. The Japanese were only interested in one piece of work. That was the patent that my colleague developed. And they closed the whole place down after a year where they came over, saw how it worked, transferred the technology to Japan, all 80 people in that company out of work. Intellectual giants, many of them, in their different fields. So the point being, how do you cope with this? How do we stop a brilliant idea coming out of Russ's lab? A company formed, and all of a sudden, somebody in China, in Japan, in England, doesn't matter where, says, oh, we like that. Buy it up because it's a free enterprise system, and then ship all the work and all the jobs somewhere else.
It's a constant risk that has to be dealt with as best you can. I mean, what your hope in that case is that when the big company swallowed up the little company, some money exchanged hands, and the inventor, the entrepreneur, perhaps had some capital to invent the next big idea. Mm-hmm. And we certainly see with incubating companies in town, there's a statistics that show that companies that have had support through an incubator have a much higher likelihood of remaining in the region than those that don't. Now, that doesn't take away the risk of a smaller company taking a look at that and swooping down.
But there's also national policy and taxes and, you know, things. You've got to make the environment here in the United States friendly for the business.
But how does that stop it being exported? I don't suppose the Japanese for 1 minute look at the taxing process here.
It was just a case this week, and I forget what it was, about windmill technology that the federal government stopped the making in China or someplace because of national security issues.
That's true. It was an investment that they made in a wind farm
in
Oregon.
Yeah,
that they stopped it. But
the federal government stopped.
Our federal government stopped the Chinese from being involved.
Oh, I see. Right. So there is sometimes in a sort of a national security environment, right, the ability to stop that from happening.
But I think your point is well taken, and it is something that is, I think, a natural occurrence that happens with ideas. And, yeah, you know, the hope in the beginning might have been that this bright student was going to develop something that would help him and his family and his friends and his neighbors, and okay, now it winds up in Japan. So,
yeah. Well, he got a great job for 3 years. He got a 5 month
allowance
at the
end. He's also getting revenue, no? Isn't he getting revenues from the license of his patent? I'm assuming he would have been an inventor, and
I don't know. We have to take
a break. It was royalties, is what I'm trying to say.
No idea.
Sometimes you sign your royalties away when you're in private industry, like I did when I worked for Exxon. They give you $1. And you sign it away.
We're going to take a break. This is Keith Pannell with Russ Chianelli, Gary Williams, Jenny Clark, the latter two from the Center for Research, Entrepreneurship, and Innovative Enterprises on the campus at the University of Texas at El Paso. We'll be straight back.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog.
And I'm Dr. David Niesel. More women are postponing childbirth, and when they're ready, often worry their baby will carry a genetic defect.
Today, a variety of genetic tests are available, but results are confirmed through invasive procedures carrying a relatively high risk of miscarriage.
Scientists predicted a non-invasive, risk-free technique was close when they discovered fragments of fetal DNA are present in the mother's blood, enough to construct the fetus's entire genome.
Recently, this was confirmed by the successful sequencing of the genome of an 18-week-old fetus. Later, when compared with the baby's genome after birth, the technique was 98% accurate, a major breakthrough in fetal genetic testing.
To do this, researchers had to differentiate fetal DNA from its mother's. First, they got cells from the father's saliva to yield his genomic sequence. They sequenced the mother's genome from her blood.
Then they isolated all the DNA fragments in the plasma portion of the mother's blood, of which 10% belongs to the fetus. Having sequenced the genomes of both parents, researchers could then pick out the fetal DNA and reassemble them to complete the fetal genome.
Researchers believe the technique may even work on a 6-week-old fetus. Getting the cost down will be key to making it available in a doctor's office.
Though parents could have their baby's entire fetal genome sequenced, it still won't rule out all genetic diseases. Only a fraction of the genes behind birth defects are known, and some merely predispose a person to disease.
In the future, geneticists will identify disease-causing genes as well as genes behind traits such as intelligence and athletic ability. Let the designer baby debate begin.
We are Drs. David Niesel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries are shaping the future of medicine. For much more on this and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Russ Chianelli, and our guests are Gary Williams and Jenny Clark from the Center for Research, Entrepreneurship, Innovative Enterprises on the campus of the University of Texas at El Paso.
Okay, now, let's say that Keith's idea has come in. He signed a non-disclosure agreement. He has a patent filed. Jenny's done this study, and her people have done this study to show that this market is enormous. What's the next step? How does he get money?
Well, one of the outcomes of a lot of the work that we do at the center is to, in concert with the entrepreneur, the inventor, is develop a business plan. That is what any investor, any good investor, is going to want to see. Just what is the technology? What's the market look like? What do the financials look like? I mean, what kind of sales are you going to get? What kind of profits are you going to make? And once we have that, then we go ahead and we look for investors that we think might be interested. We'll go to the VC firms. There's some local people in town that have made investments in various startups here in the last 5-10 years.
These are the so-called angels.
Right, the angels. While the Camino Real group per se has disbanded, there are the individuals that still are in the region that are looking for investments as we go forward. And I think since we were founded, there's been another venture capitalist firm, Cottonwood, that has established a real presence here in town looking for deals to invest in. So we're expanding our network, CREA is, in terms of people that are interested in investing in these startups. We also work very closely with the Hub of Human Innovation, which is a technology incubator in town, whose main mission is to find investors for good ideas.
So there's a network, there's an infrastructure.
There's a growing
here
network
that
right.
backs you up. You're not sort of out there
right,
on a limb.
By yourself.
Right. Well, that's nice.
Right.
Well, let's talk about some. I mean, you're 3.5 years. When you founded the center and got this Kauffman kickoff money, you obviously had a proposal that you put down to them, you know, with timelines. I mean, sort of
deliverables.
Deliverables, outcomes. How have you done? Give us some really good success stories.
You know, it's a matter of context, and it's a matter of where we started. What wasn't so clear when we got started is just how little our portfolio, patent portfolio, was. And so we struck out right away looking to expand that. So we spent a lot more time speaking with faculty and leadership on campus to stimulate idea generation that led to patents and patent
getting
filings.
Getting the ivory towers to talk to each other, for
example? Getting them to talk with each other, right, was certainly a challenge. But there were plenty of people who wanted to talk, and there were plenty of people on campus that were interested in commercializing their ideas. They just in the past never had the support or the help to be able to do that. We've had a couple of our key patents have been licensed. One to a big company that's further developing the technology.
Can you tell us what that technology is?
I can't. I can tell you what the technology is. It's a photovoltaic outcome to be used in solar cells, solar panels.
Okay.
And it's a very novel technology that actually patents with Sandia have been jointly filed. We're working actively with them to further develop the technology that hopefully, and not the too distant future, will be a candidate for bringing it to the marketplace. There's another license that we negotiated to a couple of entrepreneurs, ironically from Utah, who actually established the company here in El Paso, and we're working actively to develop the applications
for
this technology. Has medical applications.
Right.
Use of filtering light for different applications.
Okay.
So we're actually able to produce those pieces, the parts here in this region, and looking to further expand the effort.
And so, I mean, both of those, as Jenny pointed out at the beginning of the program, really it's technology-based that you're interested in, because this is where
science.
The big return can come, right? Because
right,
you can charge a lot for medical devices. You can make a mint of money if you come up with a solar cell that's really efficient and has longevity.
I think that certainly is one of the measures, but the practical measure is we sit in the middle of a campus with lots of very bright faculty and staff that are doing terrific experiments every day, and with the drive towards Tier 1, there are more of them doing more work with more funding from the federal and state governments, so there's a lot more opportunities for novel ideas to come to the fore. One of the unique characteristics of this center is that we do, quote, specialize in technology-based ideas. We
right.
do have a good knowledge of the patent system and how one goes about and does that, and the licensing process and some of the other processes of putting together a team to commercialize.
You mentioned that you know, as in all universities, there's a lot of people doing research, which is sponsored by different organizations. So the federal government, you know, sponsors a lot of research. I've had money with Los Alamos. But, you know, in that case, who owns the sort of the patent in the end? Is it shared between the university and the principal investigator and the federal government? Or does, when the federal government gives you funds to go and do something, whether it's a grant or a contract, do you automatically give away 50% of your capacity to fund that?
I've not experienced anything.
I know the answer to that because we had that case with some of the pigments we made where if it was supported by NSF, for example, or DOE or DOD, in the case of DOD, they say, well, you can do whatever you want with it, but if we want to paint our battleship with it, we do it free.
Well, that's
The inventors also, if it is licensed, once the patent costs are all paid back, the inventors share with the university 50-50% on royalties.
Right.
So it's, you know, that's why I was asking earlier what happened in that case.
Well, in the particular case I was working with Los Alamos, we tried to develop molecules to separate things like americium and plutonium. And it's very clever. It's very nice. But then, you know, who's going to use this technology? Only the people who funded it, and then maybe the Iranians. And so it didn't look like it was going to be a particularly, you know, economically viable idea. Clever, but not much money in it.
Could you tell us a little bit about how we could improve this? I know that we do a lot of talking to students. They get very excited about this. And isn't there going to be some kind of contest coming up?
Yeah, there's. We've had now a student entrepreneurship contest in March, the last couple of years, and it is again in March 8th and 9th this year. The contest basically is around who has the best ideas that are ready to be commercialized, who can write the best business plan, who can do the best 1-minute elevator pitch. You got 1 minute to tell somebody about your idea and how well are you in convincing somebody in 1 minute. It's open to student teams here in UTEP, and also we're inviting teams from NMSU and Texas Tech Medical School and the University of Juarez. If you need more information, best thing to do is to go to the CREE website, and they can get in contact with Jenny or myself, and we can provide them with more information, and more importantly, we can help them establish a full team, complement of a team. We can provide support with their market research and their business plan, and so that for many of them who have never done this before, they'll have a first experience going forward.
Every 2 years, a particular research training operation I run from the NIH, Russell and his wife Carolina come over and give a sort of a winter mester, 1 week short course on entrepreneurship as it applies to science. And then part of that, they have a homework where they get into teams of two or three and have to create some interesting something. And it was great fun last time.
And they got very excited about it,
right.
and started some what wouldn't be CREE businesses, flower pot arrangements and things like that. But my experience has been that when the students get this, it is really something they get excited about.
That's certainly what we have a scene here.
The thing I would say is that the two things that you mentioned before came out of the chemistry department. And the ACS right now is pushing this idea that—
The American Chemical Society.
Yeah, American Chemical Society, pushing this idea that for the nation, we need more entrepreneurs. We need to translate our science and engineering into jobs. And here in the border right now, we could really use them. And El Paso is a very ideal place at the moment to do this because of labor and so on and so forth. So what you're doing is something that's very important to the country and to the students and all of us.
Do you actually have outreach short courses or seminar series?
Monthly workshops.
Workships that you could send students to?
Yes,
absolutely.
Workshops.
Right.
They're free. They're held usually the third Wednesday of every month from 1 to 3. There are six basic topics that we cover over a period of 6 months, and then it recycles again. But we've also done—
But people can jump in and jump off like
exactly.
a merry-go-round.
And we've also done some specially designed workshops for groups of people that are interested.
It's Gary and Jenny. Thank you so much for being here on Science Studio. Great fun.
Dr. Gary Williams, the director of CREE, and Jenny Clark, the associate director of CREE. So if you want to be in contact for the Center for Research, Entrepreneurship, and Innovative Enterprises, just click on the UTEP website.
And go to entrepreneurship. And that's the end of the program. We've got to go. Norma, thank you very much for putting the program together again, and we'll see everybody next week. Bye-bye.